And my military service, just parenthetically, mm-hmm. believe it or not, I mean, I applied for, at the recommendation of someone at Michigan, a position in Belgium, and got it. You know, part of it was because I could speak French and Flemish and English, so I could be useful to the local population that served the base, but also, since I was a fully trained internist, I could be useful as an internist at the Shape Hospital. Yeah.
Just quickly, is there any particular, what was your experience like serving at Shape in Belgium, in the military hospital there?
You know, it was phenomenal. You know, we had doctors from all of the, Shape is the military arm of NATO.
Okay.
So the only NATO country that wasn't in Shape was France. They had withdrawn from the military part of NATO back then. That's why the hospital moved from Paris to Belgium. They had to rebuild a brand new hospital. I actually got to Belgium before the hospital was complete. But all of the other... So I met Turkish doctors and Greek doctors and English doctors and German doctors, and I got a chance to share. You know, we educated each other. I got to learn about the drugs that they were using. I got to take care of patients from the hospital part of that complex was all American. That was a 196 station hospital. So they didn't take care of any inpatients. We did all of the inpatient work, but they had clinics. So they saw outpatients, but if they were sick enough to be admitted, then they would come into the hospital and we would take care of them. And we were the only ones who were on call at night covering the emergency room, so we would take care of all nationals at night. So we to answer your question, we saw a variety of different illnesses that I hadn't seen during my residency or fellowship. We got a chance to meet colleagues from across the country. We got to, you know, meet military families, and we were part of the evacuation process for some of the soldiers that had been injured. We were very close to the Air Force and military hospitals in Germany, so we were part of the support system for the war, so we had some contact with that. So it was, you know, from a professional point of view, it was great. From an educational point of view, I was the most senior internist there for a while, so I actually was the chief of medicine, mm-hmm. you know, just as a fledgling, just out of my training, you know. But I gained some administrative experience there, mm-hmm. and as a place to live, you know, there we were, you know. So we in Belgium, so we would go to England, and you know, as a family, and we would go skiing in the Alps, and we'd go to Spain and to Italy, and you know, I mean, we just traveled when we could. Mm-hmm. On our free time, and would stay at military bases when we did that, so the expenses were low.
Yeah.
So it was a very... I mean, I would have stayed in the Army another year if they would have let me.
I just want to clarify one quick thing before we move on. This was during the Vietnam War, correct? Is there any particular reason that you were in Belgium to serve as a military doctor? Was there something going on there, or...
Well, you know, the military had to staff all of its bases.
Okay.
And, you know, they did have... Shape was an important base because it is where all of the brass in Europe was based. So we had the generals from all of these countries. Okay. So they had to keep a population of physicians there.
Okay.
I think I was very fortunate not to go to Vietnam. I mean, it's not something... I mean, I would have gone if they had asked me to go, but they didn't ask me to go. I think they thought that, given my linguistic skills and my training, I was better suited there than I would have been in a battalion traumatic environment. Mm. And, you know, for me and for my family, it was... an amazing opportunity also to avoid combat. I mean, I wasn't in combat. I was in a support role.
Yeah. And your family at this time, you and Linda, did you have children?
Yes, we had two children in Ann Arbor, okay. And one was born in Belgium.
Okay. And you mentioned that it was 1971 that you were... done with your military service, and then you went to Massachusetts General.
Right.
And then You had said that you wanted to stay in the Northeast.
Yes.
When you were all done with your training and
Yes.
residency. So
Yes.
how is it that you came to be in Cooperstown?
Yes. The way the quest went is when I was trained as a clinical rheumatologist,
Okay.
but I also learned a great deal of immunology. So I was in a position where I could have been useful in setting up an immunology laboratory program, support some research along those lines, and I also wanted to teach. I've always wanted to teach. So I looked around the Northeast for job opportunities, and the one that stood out the most was Dartmouth. I like the geography of the Dartmouth program, the Hitchcock Clinic, and I like the people who were there. And I interviewed there, and it went really well. I also looked at Portland, Maine, where there was a rheumatologist who had trained at Mass General, and I liked that, but not as much. And that was more private practice in a community hospital, and I wanted to be more part of an integrated unit where teaching, where there was an opportunity to do teaching and research. So Dartmouth was my first choice, and then I looked at a practice in Springfield, Massachusetts, and that was even more private practice oriented. And so I applied for the Dartmouth job, and at that time, they also were recruiting for a pulmonologist. And it turned out that the person that they were looking at was a friend of mine from Michigan. And they decided that year that they were going to hire one more person into the clinic, not two. So they asked me to wait a year because the greater priority for them was pulmonology. So they offered Peter the position, but I had to wait a year. And my life as a fellow was, really arduous. We got paid very little. I had three kids. The housing, was a cost. I was commuting 13 miles a day to work, and I had four other jobs in addition to my fellowship, just to make ends meet. One was working at a rehab hospital, student. I mean, I was doing a lot of different things, and it would have meant another year like that. And I just did not want to wait for another year in that environment. And then Linda's father, who was a lawyer in Waterville, he had some contact with an orthopedic surgeon at Bassett. And I'm not sure what it was about. It must have been something related to some kind of litigation. But he happened to ask him, his name was Ed Carey, if Bassett had a rheumatologist. And Ed Carey said no. So I wrote to the chief of medicine here saying, I'm looking for a position as a rheumatologist, and I understand you don't have one. Would you be interested in receiving an application from someone? And then I sent them my CV. And I had known about Bassett because Bassett is a Columbia-affiliated hospital, and while I was at Columbia, a number of my friends came here for rotations. And I think I might have too, except I was dating Linda, and I didn't want to leave her. So that's why I never came. But I knew that it was a really good place, but I'd never seen it. And he wrote me back saying, "We'd love to see you. Come on up, take a look, let's look around." And he said, "We've never had a rheumatologist." At that time, there weren't even boards in rheumatology. It's something that some people did, but it hadn't received the formal recognition of a specialty that cardiologists had. Like, you had boards in internal medicine, and then you also got tested and got boards in cardiology. The first boards in rheumatology that were ever given, I took after I was at Bassett. So, I came up and I gave a talk, and I loved it. I loved the area. I loved the hospital. I loved the people that I met. Basically, the only question that they asked me was, "Look, we're not quite sure if you'll fill up your schedule with rheumatology patients because we've been taking care of them without a rheumatologist all these years. If you're not full, would you be willing to do general medicine?" I said, "Sure, I would," because I was trained as an internist and had done that my whole time in the service. And so I then came back with my wife for a second visit, and loved it even more. So we just decided that this is what we were going to do instead of Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. And Dartmouth still, you know, at that time in my mind, would have been, if I had had both options, I probably would have preferred Dartmouth because of its location and the fact that there was a university right there. You know, I think those were appeals, and I suspected that the education for the kids would be better there, and, you know, it was closer to the big cities. I mean, there were a lot of geographic reasons, too, and there seemed to be more going on in the community in Hanover than in Cooperstown. But this seemed like, you know, a great alternative. And then just not, I mean, just to support that decision, a number of years later, not that many, 4 or 5 years later, a job opportunity at Dartmouth became available, and I was offered it, and I turned it down. And by that time, we were settled here, we were really happy. You know, all of us were happy. Linda was happy, the kids were happy, I was happy, I liked my colleagues. I had established some programs which I loved, and this was, we knew the place I wanted to be. So that's how we came to come here.
And could you, when you first started at Bassett, what was the hospital like when you started? As an institution, what was Bassett like at this time?
It was much smaller, you know, than it is now. And therefore more intimate, and people knew each other better. Mm-hmm. There was a much smaller patient population. It was just much more manageable from the social aspects of knowing staff, knowing nursing staff, knowing housekeepers, knowing everyone that worked here, and developing programs. It just was easier. It was sort of in its infancy of providing tertiary care. It was really good at providing primary care. And let me talk about the Department of Medicine, which is what I knew best. I think I was the 10th or the 11th member of the Department of Medicine. When I left it, there were about 80. You know, I mean, that just gives you an idea of the growth. But in that group of 10 or 11, there were two cardiologists. Let's just ignore that.
Okay. We can give it a second to...
Call from Anderson Vivian.
That's not for you, is it?
No.
Vivian.
They'll
leave a message.
Okay.
So,
do you want to give it a second until it's done ringing before we resume? Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm terribly... Okay, I think we're good.
So there were two card-carrying cardiologists. I mean, these were board-certified cardiologists.
Hi, this is a message for Linda and Walter Frank. Linda, I don't know if you remember me. This is John Anderson. I served on the board in Springbrook with you, and I still serve on the board after 12 years. And I just called to thank you personally for your ongoing support of Springbrook. I know that you probably follow what we do through publications and on our website, but it continues to grow, and you were part of that growth early on. So thank you for your service on the board, and thank you for continuing to support us. And I hope you have a great day. Bye-bye.
So anyway, getting back to the Department of Medicine. But, you know, the giants in the department, Bill Mook, he was a general internist who happened to do endocrinology. Hmm. He wasn't an endocrinologist, but he did endocrinology really well. And Emory Herman, who's still alive here in the community, he was a general internist, but he did hematology and pulmonary medicine. You know? And Bob Sousa was a general internist, but he also was a neurologist. Now, at that time, we did actually have another real board-certified neurologist, but Sousa knew every bit as much as he did. But, you know, so these were avocations. Don Pollock, whose wife just, her funeral was just Saturday, he was an internist who did dermatology, so he was the dermatologist. Well, you know, so these were internists who were doing everything. In the course of the next years, each one of those disciplines became divisions with many people in them, all of whom were board certified. So now there are 4 neurologists, you know, and there are seven or eight cardiologists and four rheumatologists. And so, and the internists are, there are two groups of internists, one group that do principally outpatient medicine and another who are all hospitalists. So it's become a much more sophisticated, complicated it's an organization which is really much more tertiary. A tertiary component has emerged on top of a primary care base. And the principal primary care base now is in the regional healthcare system, where we have so many family practitioners and internists and nurse practitioners and physician's assistants in all of the communities that surround Bassett that are part of the integrated healthcare system, and other hospitals that are part of the Bassett healthcare system. Back then, there was one hospital. There was one physician's assistant who did dermatology. He was the first physician's assistant in New York State. But it was just a much smaller, much tighter group with much less in the way of specialized care. But a place of academic excellence and committed to education with residency programs. Back when I came, there were programs in medicine, surgery, OB, psych, and there were five. Now they're down to three, and there have been more before that. And while in the early years, there were fellows in ophthalmology coming here from Albany who were doing a number of months here. So, there was that level of training, and there was always medical student training with students on rotations from a number of medical schools, principally Columbia, but Albany and Syracuse and Rochester, and then from around the country. So it really had all of the ingredients of a medical center, but it was with lowercase M and lowercase C.
And you had mentioned earlier when you were considering hospitals that teaching was something that you were very interested in.
Yes.
What was the importance of the academic component at Bassett for you?
Vital. I mean, the things that I could see myself doing and that I mentioned to the chief of medicine when I came here is that I could set up a clinical program, but I also could set up a training program for residents, specifically in the field of rheumatology, which I did, and a training program for medical students, which is a different curriculum because it's teaching at a different level of education. And that I could dovetail that with my immunology background, and that I could set up an immunology lab, which would provide clinical service, so we could actually do some immunology tests for the hospital, as well as an immunology research lab, where we could do research and help teach residents and staff on research that was ongoing or on some of their own projects. And one of the things that lent itself to the latter was Dave Blumenstock was the chief of surgery here at that time, and he was doing a lot of work on lung transplantations. And initially these lung transplantations were done between beagles, so that the genus of the dog, it's beagle to beagle lung transplantations. But then they started doing the transplantations crossing lines, so that they were beagle to mongrels. And they would then learn what kind of immunological interventions would be possible that would enable these lungs to survive in the recipient with radiation and with chemotherapy. And part of what would help them is looking at the transplanted lungs and seeing what immunological damage was done by the host to the lung. And that's something that my lab could provide. So we did all that. We set up a clinical lab, a research lab, and two training programs, and the clinical practice. So I was in seventh heaven.
And in addition to these clinics, what were some of the other roles that you held at Bassett from the time that you first arrived there?
Well, you know, I was involved in from the get-go and the identification of students, applicants for residencies. So that was an important part, and that fit in with my interest in teaching. I served on different committees. I ended up becoming chairman of the Medical Records Committee. You know, things like that. I can't even remember which committees I was involved with. Perhaps the most important committee work that I did was, I think, there was a group that the chief of medicine then, Joe Lunn, put together after Bill Strecker. Bill Streck, does that name ring any bells?
Oh, yes.
Bill Streck came to Cooperstown in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a visionary, and he really had a lot of ideas as to how the hospital, how the Department of Medicine could be organized. Lots of great ideas, which he bounced off the rest of us. So Joe Lunn asked us to form a committee on goals, priorities, strategies, you know, for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And we met for a year, and we met once to twice a week, usually in the evenings. And put together, and I brought it here to show it to you. Let me, it'll just take me a second to get it.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I put it in the other room.
Okay.
And this is it. And Bill was the chairman,
mm-hmm.
and then Bill Mook, Dave Svahn, I was on there, Al Kozak, and then an administrator. And we together put this whole document, which studied the department, looked at its strengths and weaknesses, and came up with a plan on how to deal with all of the important issues of access, finance, reorganization. And this actually served, this was put together in 79, and I became chief of medicine in 1980, but this served as the blueprint for what I did in organizing the Department of Medicine in the first few years.
Yeah.
That probably was the most important activity in which I was engaged and where I got to work with Bill very closely.
Yeah. And you mentioned in 1980 you become chief of medicine.
I became acting chief in 1980 and then permanent chief in 81.
Okay. And when you took on that role, what were the new responsibilities that you faced?
Well, you know, the issues were that people who came to Bassett, as I did, were given carte blanche to come. And you know, the assumption was that you could come, you would do what you did, you would work hard, you would do it well, and, you know, the outcome would be good. And, you know, it wasn't always the case. And what was evident was that there needed to become some more accountability and some more responsibility, some more clarity and definition of responsibilities, better organization, better understanding of costs, which were often ignored, not even, you know, I mean, people would order tests without even realizing how much they cost. That wasn't a factor in their thinking, because it's what they thought that they would need, and not look at alternative ways of providing the same value, you know, for less money. You know, so all of those things were issues that needed to be done. So, you know, I think that needed to be incorporated into the management culture of the department, but also of the institution. So we viewed this as an approach that would lead the organization, while at the same time, though, protecting the reasons that people came here, which were to be, this wasn't a private practice situation, so we didn't expect people to work as private practitioners. We did expect them to contribute in education, to research if that's what they wished, or to some other avocations that related to the hospital business. And we had sabbatical programs that would help encourage that and the like. But we also wanted them to stay. We wanted them to like it here. We wanted their families to like it here. So we wanted them to feel good about being engaged in the lives of their families and in their children. And for that, there would be, you know, an economic sacrifice. I mean, you couldn't earn as much as you could if you were in private practice. And, you know, people who came here accepted that because they were choosing, I mean, they still were being well paid, you know, certainly on an absolute scale, not as well paid as private practitioners, but we wanted to make sure that they were paid comparably to those who were in situations that were like ours, like other clinics, like, you know, not to say that we're the Mayo Clinic, but to systems that were organized like that, where they valued these other missions, you know, where there was recognition of the importance of devoting time to academics. That was my charge.
And I think with academics again, have, in your estimation, how has medical education at Bassett changed from the time you arrived during your tenure, particularly during your tenure as chief of staff?
Medical education has changed a great deal, as has the distribution of physicians in healthcare. And part of it is economics, just part of it, and part of it is the evolution of technology. But let me just talk about the economics for a moment. When I came, hard to believe as it may be, all of the physicians at Bassett were on the same salary scale, be you a neurosurgeon or a pediatrician. You know, you got $1,000 more if you passed your boards, you know, and then you advanced as long as you did your job well, to what, to the degree that the organization could afford. Now, the disparity between what people earn at places like this, including this, you know, goes, you know, from, I'm going to guess now at numbers because I'm not really privy to what people in other departments make, but probably from 150 to 550, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that disparity just didn't exist. And that disparity is now also known to medical students as they're looking for residency. I mean, it's not just Bassett, it's the world out there. Mm-hmm. And that 550 in private practice could be millions in the right community and with the right practice set up. And the issue of debt has just risen exponentially, as it has for all students, colleges, medical schools, and the like. So it's not at all unusual for medical school graduates to have $200,000 worth of debt. So the attractiveness of primary care fields economically, you know, is just much less appealing to individuals than nowadays than it was back in the 70s. Back in the 70s, most of the applicants to Bassett, again, your question reflected our experience here, were for the internal medicine residencies. And I remember we used to have 150 to 200 applicants for 6 or 8 positions, and all from great medical schools, you know, and we ended up with great residents. In the last 10 years, or the last 20 years, we've had to, there's been such an attrition of U.S. graduates looking for primary care residencies everywhere, including here, that we've had to actively seek the best possible candidates from the world. Henry Weil went to Thailand, you know, to establish links with medical schools there. And now we have some Thai residents who are very good and often end up going to fellowship programs at Mass General or, you know, at University of Michigan or Michigan State and setting up cath labs and the like. I went to Ireland and England, you know, to recruit from those medical schools. And Al Kozak came with me one of the times that I went, and Jim Tolton's been. So, you know, we've really had to struggle to find quality residents. And we have. And we now have, and we continue to have quality residents, good doctors. But they're not from our own culture. And that's created a problem for the community to some degree, because they don't understand their doctors as well. And it's created, you know, some cultural problems for them coming here and living here in places that are so alien to where they were born and raised. You know, they have their own communities, but we, you know, we have residents from India, from Pakistan in the same program. You know, two countries that are traditional foes. You know, so it's so the competition for primary care residencies has become an enormous quantum shift in all of the years that I've been here. The quality of education, I think, has continued to excel. And I think that the medical school, the introduction of the medical school program,